Okay, welcome to the Animal Voices.
Is my mic on? Yes, yes.
Welcome to the Animal Voices radio show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, November 18th, 2011. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I'm joined here today by my co-host, Tara Gardner, our guest co-host, Alyssa Ray, and our control room tech trainee, Morgan Ahoff. On today's show, our first segment will be presented by Alyssa, and it's entitled Love, Sex, and Veganism, Dating with the Animals in Mind. This is a topic that I think is on the forefront of consideration for all those who choose to eschew animals from our diet and lifestyle, but still value and desire romantic or physical relationships with other people, as most of us human beings do. It's the social aspect of veganism that is the most challenging and not the food. On today's show, we'll discuss tips for vegans, vegetarians, and those transitioning on navigating the dating realm. Alyssa will offer suggestions on how to frame animal ethics to potential lovers and encourage our partners to make the connection. We'll ponder whether or not vegans and non-vegans can live happily ever after, tell our listeners about awesome vegan safer sex products, and answer the question, just what is a vegan sexual? That segment is coming up soon in about 15 minutes. And for our feature interview today, we have Scotland Hasley on the show, who is the founder and president of Animal Rescue Corps, which is a fairly new but very active and accomplished nonprofit organization based in the United States and works in North America and worldwide on large-scale animal rescues where these rescues are needed. Currently, Scotland and his team of volunteers are situated in Lac-Simon in northern Quebec, where they are undertaking a great dog rescue action known as Operation Anishinaabe. And Scotland will be on the show today to tell us about this huge undertaking and about the organization. So we were away last week for the Remembrance Day holiday, but the weekend before that, Tara, Alyssa, and I all attended the fantastic and inaugural Vegan Vancouver Prom, which Tara would like to tell us about.
Yes. So 2 weeks ago was Vegan Prom. I had an amazing time myself. My husband and I started the night off by going to Vegan Mischief, which was a secret supper dinner. And then we hopped over next door to the Vegan Prom. There were drinks, tons of delicious vegan food, an awesome DJ, and a photo booth to create lasting memories. I met lots of new people and had a blast, you know, busting a move on the dance floor. What did you guys think of a Vegan Prom?
I thought it was fantastic. It was fun. It was, what I really liked was the atmosphere of, like, you just knew that everyone was compassionate, which sounds kind of dumb, and just friendly and open to the same ideals.
Yeah.
That, I mean, not to say that everyone there was vegan, right? But
definitely open,
you know,
to the idea.
Just open to the idea.
Or knew
different.
Somebody that's
yeah.
vegan or, yeah, definitely.
So with that in mind, I thought it was a fantastic success. Yeah, it was really good, and I enjoyed myself. And
for the first time, that I thought the turnout was amazing.
Amazing.
I was afraid, you know, tickets weren't selling very
fast. Yeah, there were over 200 people there.
Yeah, it really felt
full. I think there'll
be more decorations
next
year. Were awesome.
Amazing.
And
it was so beautiful.
A chance to dress up and just hang out and just be relaxed with people instead of it all being around, you know, serious animal issues, which that's really important stuff, but it's really important to just bond and create community and relax and have fun.
Yes, absolutely. That's a really good point that we need to...
We don't often get the chance to
relax.
I mean, eating's often a large part of it, but dancing is not. I've never seen so many
vegans
in one room dancing before.
And I like the alcohol part.
Yeah. I didn't even notice that part.
You wouldn't.
Since I don't drink, But were people drunk? I didn't even notice that. It didn't seem like a high school dance, which is probably the last dance I went to. Well,
it was,
maybe.
It was so much fun. I love that everybody was dancing. That was my favorite part, because there's sometimes people don't want to dance. And
you know, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of people being animal rights people there. There's a lot of sadness in the world that you come across just being aware of these situations and just being able to put that aside for one night and
enjoy
be
yourself.
Happy.
Yeah.
Not that we're a bunch of sad, depressed people, but.
No, not at all.
But yeah, it was just a good time. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, yeah, Tara, so you wanted to tell us that...
Oh, yes.
The people that put the Vegan Prom on.
It was such a success. Yes, that they have organized a groups, since they had such great reviews, and are thinking of starting an event planning business, which is called...
I didn't know about the business.
Vegan That's Party cool. Directive, which I assume it will be a business and not an organization or...
I assume that they're all volunteers. Two of the ladies in the group are actually friends of mine. One of them is Krista, who used to be on the show here. She used to be co-host. And my friend Melissa. Mm. And they did this all volunteers. So thank you, Melissa, Krista, and the rest of your group. And
yes,
they're called
you.
The Vegan Party Directive now. And you can like them on Facebook. So look out for that.
Okay, awesome. Yeah. All I have is just what I've heard around. So
Vegan Party Directive on Facebook. So last week, the BCSPCA held a special fundraiser event that I attended on behalf of Animal Voices entitled Understanding the Animals in Your Life, a Special Evening with Dr. Temple Grandin. This is an event that I was particularly intrigued to be present at, as I find Temple Grandin to be a curious enigma of a person who dedicates her career to working for the animals, but yet consequently harms the animals in doing so. If you haven't heard of her before, well, Dr. Temple Grandin is described by the BCSPCA, at least, as perhaps the best-known animal welfare authority in the world. That's quite a prestigious title, isn't it? There was an HBO biopic made about her recently, which you may have heard of or seen, and she was also named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in the World in 2010. She also has a doctorate degree in animal science. And so I had the honor of attending this 45-minute talk in Vancouver last week by Dr. Grandin on the subject of understanding animals, followed by a 45-minute question period from the audience. Dr. Grandin gave a very lively and engaging presentation, complete with PowerPoint, on explaining to us basically how animals think and thus how we should treat animals as individuals to appropriately get along well with them. Of course, if you didn't know this, I should point out that Temple Grandin is autistic, and she explained to the audience how it is the animals and autistic humans, or how it is that animals and autistic humans relate synonymously with each other. That is, they both think in pictures, whereas non-autistic human beings think in words. And also, like autistic people, the world for an animal is sensory-based. I have to say that what she said about this made sense to me, and she gave lots of examples of how this is so, such as explaining that in a slaughterhouse, it's the shadows of the hanging chains that will scare the cows more than anything else. This may seem very benign to human beings, but to animals like cows, it is not. Temple Grandin is well known for working in slaughterhouses across North America to improve conditions in them for the animals. That is, until they die, of course. And this is where the controversy among her and animal rights activists arises. More than half the cattle in Canada and the U.S. are slaughtered using handling equipment in chutes designed by Dr. Grandin. So whereby Dr. Grandin claims to share a special empathy with the animals, where she can personally sense what they are feeling and especially understand them in that way, she uses that empathy to systematically promote the efficacy of the slaughter businesses itself, thereby directly contributing to the killing of these kindred souls of hers in the process. So I'm curious to know what you all think of this. Alyssa, you say that you're creeped out by Temple Grandin. Please explain.
Just to have such a respect and love for animals and contribute to their killing. Yeah, that's creepy.
Does she love them, though? I didn't get that feeling for her. She always referred to the animals as it. And when you love someone, they're not an it.
Well, an object.
I'll tell you a little bit why I find it creepy. The first time I was introduced to her, I saw her on this program called First Person by director Errol Morris. He has this... The whole show was about people who dealt with death and had weird, creepy jobs or weird lives that intersected with death a lot. And you got to actually see Temple Grandin in her going through the slaughter channel, and then in this mechanism she made that squeezes the animal and comforts them right before death. And she was inside that.
So she did show her. She did show an really empathetic side.
In it she did. But it just seems like a disconnect. I don't relate to, and I find disturbing.
I definitely don't understand it. I don't understand how you could, she thinks that she feels the same way that they feel and then not be scared when the death is coming, the murder is going to happen.
The only way that you could do that is if you thought that it was absolutely necessary for our human health to continue to eat animals.
And she never actually did bring that up in her talk at all. She spoke about the whole process very systematically, very like logically and unbiased. Like
she's not really a feely person.
Like she wasn't a human being.
Yeah, she's a robot.
Well, she is a human being. And that's...
I mean, sorry.
That's the enigma part of her, I find. You know, it's just that, you know, always referring to the animals as it, but yet saying that she understands how they are feeling, that they have emotions. She made an argument for that. She said dogs react to Prozac the same way that humans do. Therefore, their neurotransmitters work the same and they have the same emotions. She knows that. There was a Q&A period after the talk, which actually went for as long as the talk itself. And I found that the questions were really docile in nature. People were asking basically about very specific questions about how they could get their cat, dog, or rabbit to behave. And but there were a few riveting questions on slaughterhouse issues and animal research. A few people asked about livestock transportation problems. They asked if using closed-circuit television in slaughterhouses was a good idea, which Temple Grandin actually said they're doing that in the States. So, yeah, in conclusion, I'd like to learn more about her. I do have one of her books that I want to read. As I said, she's this intriguing anomaly to me, and part of this is because she completely struck me as being incapable of actually BSing anyone, which I definitely respect. You got that feeling from her, and I do feel I could have a really honest and open conversation with her about animal welfare and animal rights without her being on the defensive or skirting around the matter or not just really having a firm position on the topics of at hand, which I didn't get the feeling from her, and that would be a nice change to get from someone associated with the animal slaughter industry. Just to be able to have an open and honest conversation. I think we certainly need more of that in kind of transparency. So if people who are listening want to get more information on Temple Grandin, you can visit her website, which is grandin.com. And now I have our events. So today, from November 17th to the 19th, and that's today and tomorrow, the Interactive Futures Animal Influence Conference is continuing at Emily Carr University of Art and Design in Vancouver on Granville Island, featuring such guests as respective cognitive ethicist Mark Beckoff, who we had on the show 2 weeks ago, and international new media artist Lisa Jevbrat. This year's Interactive Futures Conference will be focused on the ways that art is influenced by our growing knowledge of the emotional, cognitive, and moral lives of animals. Animal Influence will host workshops and concurrent exhibitions, performances, and screenings that will offer opportunities for in-depth conversations and discussions between cognitive ethologists, biologists, psychologists, philosophers, artists, and public policymakers whose work has helped to shift assumed conventions concerning animal cognition, consciousness, and agency, as well as reveal possibilities for the development of new media implementing image, text, and sound and video. We actually did an interview on what to expect at this conference 2 weeks ago with one of the organizers. Tara, you went to the reception last night, and you'll be attending the conference on behalf of Animal Voices this week, so I look forward to hearing about that next week.
Yes.
And if you want to find more out about the conference, go to interactivefutures.ca. On Wednesday, November the 23rd, from 6 till 9 p.m., Liberation BC's monthly volunteer community night will be happening at the Mount Pleasant Community Center at No. 1 Kingsway in Vancouver. So for this month's volunteer night, Liberation BC will be holding a letter writing session. Topics will be provided, but if there is a topic that you would like to bring to the group, you can do that if you want to attend. And also, if you haven't heard, and we have talked about this on the show before, the first Saturday of every month has been declared Vegan T-Shirt Day. So bring a T-shirt to this volunteer night to paint your favorite vegan logo on. Paints and brushes will be provided. Snacks will be provided too. Next Friday is World Fur Free Friday, and there's two demonstrations actually happening in Vancouver next Friday, November the 25th, both starting at 12 p.m. I'll have to go through them very quickly here. So the first one's happening at the corner of Georgia and Granville Streets in downtown Vancouver. This demo is being held by CATCA, which is Campaigns Against the Cruelty to Animals, and they will be gathering at 12 p.m. at the corner of Georgia and Granville Street in downtown Vancouver. And they will have placards and educational materials for this demo. Then there's another demo. It's actually in March, happening same time, 12 to 3 p.m. at the Vancouver Art Gallery in downtown Vancouver. This is a rally and march in solidarity with our non-human brothers and sisters who are being continually tortured and murdered for the greed of humans. And this demonstration and march is being sponsored by Food Not Bombs. So that's happening, two events happening for World for Free Friday. And I know that there are other events happening worldwide. So if you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to have announced on the show, please email us the details at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, or you can post it on our Facebook page, which is Animal Voices Vancouver. And now, Alyssa.
No PRA?
No. Oh,
I mean,
and now the announcement.
Announcement, that's what it's called.
Join your hosts, Eve, Motomasa, Kuma, and Androgenoid, for a tour of electronic beats, each Thursday night at midnight. Art of Beats, live, direct to you, right here on Vancouver's Community Voice, CFRO 102.7 FM.
You're listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7, airing from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, on unceded Coast Salish territory. And now I'm going to talk a little bit about dating and love and veganism. So most people find that making the shift towards a more animal-friendly lifestyle, aka going vegetarian or vegan, that the most challenging part isn't the food, but rather the social aspect. Wearing your conscience on your sleeve brings other people's ethics into question and makes for some delicate situations. In today's lifestyle segment, we're going to talk about the oft painstaking process of finding and keeping and loving a mate. And So dedicating one's life to reducing animal suffering and being acutely aware of the horrors of the animal industries, namely animal agriculture, is a lofty and commendable pursuit. Taking animal products off the plate and committing oneself to ending animal commodification are expressions of deeply held values which become an undeniable part of the very fabric of our being. When weaving our lives intimately with another's, it's important that our own fabric stays strong and bold. That was my bus poetry this morning. We have some important questions to ask ourselves when navigating the dating realm, which is harrowing enough on its own. Namely, is consuming animal products a deal breaker? Is the very idea of sharing a bed and a life with someone such a turnoff that it's deemed unacceptable? If so, that's what's called a vegan sexual, if it is deemed completely unacceptable to, you know, mate and procreate with people who
and there's a Facebook page for vegan sexuals.
Right.
You can like it.
I haven't actually.
Yes, I have.
I wasn't aware of that actually. So already the dating pool is super small and difficult. And if you decide that you can't stand the thought of being intimate with someone who chooses to support animal exploitation, then off you go to find a lovely vegan. Yes, the pool is small, and what I would suggest with such a specific niche is I think it unwise to rely on chance encounters. I urge people to take the leap into online dating, unless you're in a big city like Portland or New York or something.
VeggieDate.com, VeggieConnection.com, those are a couple.
VeggieRomance.com, VeggieDating, yeah, I think you said, VeganPassions.com.
Wow.
VegConnect.com. Ethical Singles, Veggie Fishing.
I think they should just all amalgamate into one because the pickings are so slim anyways, you know? Why
so
many?
And then you have to make a profile on every one, like which, I'm not exactly sure which ones are the most popular because I am not a vegan sexual. For many reasons, mostly because, yeah, the pool is really small. And I feel like I've already met most of the vegan. I mean, I'm sure there's lots out there.
That's the problem, too, is even when you live in a large city like Vancouver, you know all the vegan males out there if you're a female.
Yeah.
And there's not that many.
I know.
You know all the vegetarian males. There's not that many.
It's a great idea to, you know, not you know, specifically look for vegans, and I think it's a great outreach tool as well to date a meat eater and do outreach with them and
that's
tell
Tara's
them your
strategy.
Views.
Sure. Well, yeah, no, I've done that for sure. And I have vegan exes because of me.
Amazing. Good job for you.
Yay. There's actually a quote by Ingrid Newkirk, who is the what's her position? She works with PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And she said this: if you get someone to see how wonderful a vegan diet is, I say dump him or her. Move on now. It's their turn to go out and get somebody else over to our side. When you talk to people, one of the strongest reasons they go veg is because they had a partner who was veg. So that's interesting.
That is so interesting. I love that
dating
quote.
As a tool for outreach. If you decide to kind of go that route to opening up to omnivores, there is, of course, various reasons sort of why people are omnivores, and it definitely widens the dating pool. So I think it's important to look at sort of why someone isn't. Perhaps they don't have the information. Perhaps mm-hmm. they haven't been exposed to how horrific things really are.
And I think mm-hmm. that explains the majority of people's perceptions, just men, women, worldwide. And I think that's to be almost even assumed, unless someone, like, you're not going to meet that many people who have strident values for killing animals and eating meat. Mm-hmm. In fact, there are statistics that say that 95% of people are against animal cruelty.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, yeah, people have generally good hearts and open minds, and I think that's kind of what it's about.
Yeah, you're not going to be interested in the person if they don't, right?
Yeah, and I think it comes down to shared values and similar ethics. If a person shows that they're trying to live their life ethically with an open heart and open mind, as I said, that's undeniably attractive. And I just kind of, like, what are some shared values and lifestyle traits, like, do you think that are attractive, that maybe the person's not necessarily vegan, but they might be open to it? That's what I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. And it's things like, you know, reverence for nature.
Open-mindedness.
Exactly. Open to new ideas, hungry for knowledge, likes animals and children.
Yeah.
I mean, just doesn't necessarily want to have children, but likes them.
With other animals.
Can empathize with other creatures. Or maybe has a job helping people or doing good for the world or working in social justice.
So sexy.
Or just general, like anti-oppression values. I think those are all sort of things that I'm looking for and that we should all be looking for. And that means maybe they might be open down the road. But then
we all started, most of us started that way anyways.
Yep.
So definitely don't be judgmental, because that used to be you, right?
Yeah, barely anyone is born vegan. Yep, exactly. I do have a quote here from Terry Hope Romero. She's the author of Veganomicon, Vegan Cupcakes Take Over the World, and Viva Vegan, I think, yes. And she says, relationships are complex things, and to hinge them on just one aspect doesn't make them any easier. In this world where there are perfectly wonderful people who eat meat and there are some unpleasant people who are vegan, what is most important if you're a vegan dating an omnivore is that this person is respectful of your lifestyle choices. And if they're millionaires and gorgeous, more power to you. I think that's the key word, is respect.
Yeah.
And of course, yes. What was I going to say? Respect. Barometer for respect. I think it's a good sort of like filter for mm-hmm. kind of filtering out people who, sort of the undesirables or people who just don't respect you or are closed-minded. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's like if they can accept that you're vegan and they think that's awesome, then they're
go
pretty
after
awesome.
Them.
Yeah, I've met a lot of people that they couldn't do the diet, but they really admire the fact that you're so passionate about your cause.
Yeah, and I think that's the key too, is kind of how you frame it. Like if people frame it sort of apologetically or like it's a disease or something, like,
never be apologetic for your values.
No, it's like, oh, I'm vegan, I can't do that.
Sorry,
like, that's not attractive.
No.
But if you're like, I'm vegan, it's awesome, and this is an awesome restaurant, and this is awesome food, and
be a joyful vegan, and it's going to pass on.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And not only to the people you're dating, if they do accept you in your life, you're going to meet their friends and their families, and that's all opportunities for showing how awesome living a compassionate life is.
Mm-hmm.
and there are sort of graceful ways to navigate those situations. So just being aware that that, like, it can create tension and disharmony. But yeah, you kind of have to do a bit of extra work to kind of make, like, smooth things over.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so talking about just people's reactions to veganism, and so sensing someone's disrespect. Obviously, if someone gets defensive or makes jokes or talks about how delicious their meat dish is,
ugh,
or tries to tempt
that.
You to taste it or something,
ew,
they might very well be revealing their true colors.
You don't really want people like that just as friends, even.
No. But that said, I don't think I would necessarily write someone off who is otherwise open-minded and considerate, because sometimes there's kind of that knee-jerk, like, just awkwardness. Mm-hmm. Like I don't know how to deal with this. I feel uncomfortable, so I'm going to joke about it. But then I think if they kind of see how you react and they apologize, and if you express how important it is to you, and then they continue doing it, obviously, mm-hmm, that's not
they
cool.
Might,
but
they
I
might
say give
understand.
A chance.
Yeah, they just might not understand how serious and how passionate and how that really makes you feel.
Yeah.
And if they just don't understand it.
Yeah, and if you, like, can keep your ground and say how passionate you are and how it makes you feel, or why, you know, animal suffering is important, and bring it back to the animals and back to heart.
Mm-hmm.
I think that kind of goes a long way, and kind of go from there.
Absolutely.
And I think, yes, of course, some people get in relationships with omnivores and then they kind of slide, back to eating animal products again because they're around their partner so much. And it's so hard to say no to someone you really like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you kind of get those rose-colored glasses. And
well, as I was saying before, I think it kind of depends on who the boss is in the relationship.
Yeah,
because
power dynamics.
I'm a real bossy person, and it would not be hard for me to...
I mean,
it really depends where your values are. And I'm not going to say, oh, you're eating meat and I really love you, so I guess I'll eat meat now too. Like, what is that?
You know?
Don't be weak.
Yeah.
Be strong in your values.
And don't let yourself be bullied. And anyone who kind of pushes you to go beyond your moral and ethical boundaries, like, that's not cool.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you state this is important to me and it matters and I, you know, expect your support, then if they don't, then move on.
Yeah.
Like, find someone else who wants to support you trying to be your best person.
And that can be said with all your values, not just veganism and animal issues.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And for omnivores, I think dating vegans, it's really important to show that they have respect of the values and lifestyle choices. And it's my opinion that it's incredibly easy to woo a vegan. Maybe I'm just, like, saying that I'm incredibly easily
especially
wooed.
Especially if you're a woman.
But, okay, if there's someone you like and they, like, suggest going to a vegan restaurant, they're like, oh, I can't wait to take you out to, you know, this vegan restaurant.
Done.
How cute is that? Or, like, or if they don't eat meat in front of you, like, I kind of expect that. That's my line. And I'll let people know, especially if it's, like, you know, I'm getting to
and
like them a lot.
If they do eat meat in front of you, that's a big turn off.
No, for sure. For sure it is. Mm-hmm. I'll let it go maybe the first date or so, but then, like, I don't want it in my house and I don't want to see it. And that's my line.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yep.
And also just being careful with being argumentative off the bat. Like, I think it's important to just be nice, be joyful, see where someone is sort of coming from,
mm-hmm,
before getting into the kind of arguments.
Open-mindedness.
Exactly.
Not being defensive.
And then there's being with someone and encouraging a transition, which I don't really have time to get to today. I wish I did. But basically,
talk about it another time.
It's exactly, we should. It's about letting people decide on their own. I don't ever push anything on anyone. I'm just myself. I'm passionate, but I never want anyone to do it for me.
Live by example.
And you know, give information, but let it be books and not me preaching or whatever, like, or movies.
Mm-hmm.
And just finally, I just wanted to mention that there are, when we get to the down and dirty part, if you found someone awesome that you want to get with, there's a lot of
vegan products. So things like condoms and lube and stuff like that are often tested on animals or contain things like dairy derivatives. And there's lots of options, not lots, but there are brands that sell options at vegan reputable stores like Carmivore in the Lower Mainland and online. So keep that in mind.
Safe sex with wide condoms.
And I'm just finishing here and just... also, there's alternatives to leather, and check out vegporn.com if you're interested in that kind of thing. All the models on that photo site are vegetarian or vegan, and they also list sites that are run by herbivores. And that's it for me today.
Lovely. Thank you so much.
All right, so you are listening to Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia. So in the news this week, NFL player Tony Fometa tells ESPN that he is transitioned to a vegan diet. So Dallas Cowboys fullback and former Carolina Panthers player Tony Fometa has revealed to ESPN that he has adopted a plant-based diet. Tony transitioned to veganism over the summer after reading some books and changing his mind about his dietary habits. The 25-year-old football player who is 6 feet tall and weighs 242 pounds said that it took him about a week to transition from a meat based and a dairy based diet to a vegan diet. So I think that's amazing. It's somebody that, you know, men think, you know, oh, he must be eating lots of protein and he's on a vegan diet, and it shows that you can get protein on a
vegan diet. It's always great when big buff men who are involved in sports or bodybuilding or something really where they're really muscly show that they can get all their nutrients from plants and be compassionate.
Yay. Absolutely. Yes. And Dungeons of Dreadmoor players will be able to add veganism to their skills in an upcoming expansion. So a video game is including veganism in the play. So the popular video game is growing both its content and compassion. Independent software developer Gaslamp Games recently revealed screenshots of an upcoming expansion, and players will be able to develop veganism as a new skill for their characters. The screenshot shows an example of a level 5 vegan.
Oh, cool.
I thought that was awesome, which makes the character privy to the inner secrets and methods of the vegans. Since the expansion will also allow characters to battle monsters and become big game hunters, the development will allow players to explore ethical dilemmas while playing the fantasy game.
Neat.
I think that's really cool. They make people, you know, gamers think about, you know, those kinds of, you know, thought processes, I guess.
Awesome.
Yeah, and Tuesday night, PBS premiered My Life as a Turkey, which I watched last night. So My Life as a Turkey is a fascinating glimpse into the lives of animals who are often seen as little more than Thanksgiving centerpieces. The film follows Joe Hutto as he raises 16 turkeys left on his porch as eggs from hatchlings to adulthood. So I watched this last night with Carissa, and it really gives you a better understanding of how very intelligent these animals really are. I really enjoyed it, and the way that they communicate, like you can hear the difference.
Turkeys are amazing creatures, and mm-hmm. it's actually American Thanksgiving next week, but we had our mm-hmm. Thanksgiving, and I just want to put a plug out for our Thanksgiving show from this year, which is last month. Look it up on our website, animalvoices.org, to find out more about turkeys.
Yes, please do. I really loved it. You could tell the difference when they saw, like, rattlesnakes and different types of snakes. They made different calls, warning, you know, whether it was a venomous snake or whether it wasn't a venomous snake. So I thought that was so interesting how intelligent they are. And that is all the news that I have for this week.
Thank you, Tara.
You're welcome.
Thank you for that, Tara. Today's feature interview is with Scotland Hazley, who is the founder and president of the nonprofit animal protection organization Animal Rescue Corps. Animal Rescue Corps' mission is to end animal suffering through direct and compassionate action and to inspire the highest ethical standards of humanity towards animals. And currently, Scotland and his team are doing so as they have field teams on the ground in northern Quebec at this time, implementing a precedent-setting humane solution to the roaming dog problem faced by one native community. Scotland is here to talk to us today about this major dog rescue operation, Operation Anishinaabe, as well as some of the other work that ARC has been involved with. Hello, Scotland, and welcome to the Animal Voices radio show.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
So I first wanted to say that it is an honor to have you on the show today. I've been wanting to have you on for some time now since I first learned about Animal Rescue Corps this summer at the Animal Rights Conference. And I did actually take your training workshop there, as did our co-host Tara. So thank you for taking the time out of your day today to speak with us amongst the work that you're busy doing. So,
well, it's my pleasure. It's been an exhausting couple of weeks on this rescue, but I'm glad to tell the story. And we have a tremendous story to tell here. We've collectively done some amazing work, and I believe we have set this community and hopefully others up for success in the future.
So as far as I know, Animal Rescue Corps is a very new organization, but yet it amazes me how much you've already accomplished in direct action for the animals since starting. Could you start by giving some history first on how you came to start the organization and speak about the purpose of ARC, which I know is threefold: in conducting rescues, public education, and training?
Certainly. We've been in existence since the 11th of January this year. Obviously, I and other members of ARC have a great deal of experience coming into ARC. I've been in the field of animal protection for about 20 plus years now, starting off as a humane officer in Washington, and have had the great honor to travel the globe protecting animals. I was the director of the Manhattan Shelter in New York. I was the director of the executive director of the Washington Animal Rescue League, where I built a cageless animal shelter there, led a $6 million campaign to build this shelter. I acted as the director of emergency services and the rescue team for the Humane Society of the United States for several years, and I had always identified the need to have one focused organization who operated on an international level that could fill the gap and provide a massive resource for large-scale suffering. You know, many of these communities that we go into don't have humane societies or animal protection groups within their counties or cities, and so it was important to create that, be that resource. So we investigate cruelty on a large scale, we investigate suffering on a large scale, and we design the necessary components to come in and address them, whether it be puppy mills, dog fighting, natural disasters, hoarding cases, or in this most current case, addressing an entire community of an Anishinaabe Nation, which is a First Nation community in Lac Simon, Canada.
Who is the organization made up of? Are you all volunteer-run?
Well, we are 100% volunteer-run. I'm hoping that will change in the near future, but right now we do not have the funds to put myself or anybody else on salary. So everything that we've done is through private contributions of individuals, very caring people. We've had some great initial contributors that have helped us get off the ground to conduct these rescues. These rescues are quite expensive. They range from $25,000 to $50,000 to $75,000.
Wow.
It takes a lot in the human resources, the equipment, the cages, the food, everything necessary to go in and set up, you know, a massive operation for several weeks at a time.
So please do tell us about Operation Anishinaabe, which is, I believe, where you are still currently located in Lac Simon in northern Quebec. ARC has undertaken this operation to rescue hundreds of roaming dogs from a First Nations community. And I understand it was the community itself who asked you to intervene. Can you tell us how this happened and what the mandate of this rescue operation has been?
I'd be glad to. You know, I did a couple puppy mill raids in Quebec. I think I've done about 4 puppy mill rescues and 2 sled dog rescues in Quebec. And starting back in 2008, when I first learned of these cullings, these roundups that occur in the northern native reserves in northern Quebec and beyond. And it's very common practice that annually these communities will round up their stray dogs, their roaming dogs, which are typically hundreds of them at once. They'll round them up and they'll kill them either through gas or gunshot. It's very common. There is no management system in place throughout the year. Very few laws, if any. And it's widely accepted. And once I learned that, you know, these dogs, they get rounded up and people are invited to, you know, if they don't want their animal anymore, to tie them up at the local dump. And on X day, 2 men will go out there and shoot them.
Oh,
once I learned,
gosh.
I knew we had to find a way to eventually get in, create a model to address this, and a model that others could follow. So I've been wanting this for years. And we put the word out that this is something that we could do. We had a community with open arms request our services. We put together, it was several months of planning, we put together this massive operation that included education for the entire community, spay and neuter for all the claimed animals in the community, adoption for all of the unclaimed animals, and obviously a management system in place for when we leave. So this community, for example, spends $3,700 a year killing the animals. Hmm. They are now have agreed to apply those funds to a management position, a humane officer, if you will, that we are training and setting up for success. And this person will manage the population, and as strays come about, they'll work with us and other groups to transport those animals. So they're no longer in a position where they've got 250 dogs roaming the streets in a pack mentality.
So this is going to be a long-term solution, which is great. I'm curious to know why the problem exists in the first place. Why are the dogs roaming free and not spayed and neutered? What is your thought on that?
Well, it's like any other community: lack of education, lack of legislative efforts, or at least enforcement of those legislative efforts. But this was a community where they could write their own mandates. We wrote them for them, or we worked with them in writing these mandates. They agreed. They put out a mandatory spay-neuter on the reserve, gave everybody the opportunity to either keep their animal or not. If those chose to keep an animal, they are now spay-neutered. When I went into, I spoke to the entire 3rd through 6th grade in the entire high school on this community. And in both cases, when I asked the question, who knew what spay and neuter was, not a hand was raised.
So it really is a lack of education, and I really do commend you for going into the community to implement that education there. And from what I understand, I just read on your Facebook page actually last night, you have already placed 200 animals, is that correct, in homes?
We've spayed and neutered about 200 that remain in the community, and we placed 100 that were unclaimed, either unclaimed or given up to us.
That's incredible.
But as you said, we just placed the final couple dogs last night.
So I know, as you were saying, it's very expensive to undertake a project like this. You were saying $75,000. It involves a large cost for the veterinarian care and to all these dogs. As a nonprofit organization, how are these expenses being funded? And you mentioned that the community itself is contributing a small portion, but what about the rest? And what kind of monetary help do you need with huge undertakings like this?
Well, it was important not to take from the community. You know, we wanted to provide for the community and set them up for success. So we took nothing from them other than having them apply the 3,700 they use to kill the annually to a humane officer position. But beyond that, we, in order to get us boots on the ground to start this process, I needed to reach out to a few very generous donors of ours, and the first one that came through and with the most, which was $25,000, is a good friend of the organization, Adi Gill, mm-hmm. also a friend of animals everywhere, Adi Gill World Conservation. So he got us on the ground. Some other donors also contributed large chunks to get us moving, but we are probably over budget by a few tens of thousands, so obviously there's great need to continue to raise funds not only for this project, but future projects. We've done, this is our 12th since we've been founded, so that's 12 in 1 year so far, which is not too shabby. And we can just continue to grow and increase those numbers.
That is incredible, 12 rescues. I'm part of a lot of volunteer groups, and I can say that I'm not used to seeing all volunteer-run organizations like yours be so proactive. So since Animal Rescue Corps was started this year, can you tell us about some of these other large-scale rescue operations that you have conducted?
Yes, well, and thank you for the compliment. I'm obviously quite proud of what we've done, incredibly proud of the compassion soldiers that we've adopted to conduct these rescues. We've got well over 1,000 volunteers throughout the U.S. and Canada as of now, as well as Korea, and that number will continue to grow. Just a brief snapshot of what we've done thus far is we've rescued well over 1,000 animals that include the native reserve, a couple hoarding cases, a horse cruelty case, several puppy mills, a natural disaster, a shelter that caught on fire, and a monkey rescue. Oh, and a bird mill as well, a parrot mill.
And a lot of dog hoarding situations, too. I'm not sure if you mentioned that, which is just, it's a huge problem, I know. I'm curious as to how Animal Rescue Corps fits in with local and national agencies of law enforcement, such as the police and humane societies and SPCAs. I know you work alongside with them, but I also see that your organization is actually taking a role of authority itself in carrying out these large-scale rescues that might otherwise not take place. And you did mention that you step into communities where these kinds of organizations are lacking. How do you see your role in animal protection that is not being addressed elsewhere?
I think it's a great question. I appreciate you asking the question. You know, in most of the communities that we work in, whether it be a puppy mill or a dog fighting case or whatever it may be, the local authorities typically know of the situation or have a general idea that this has been occurring in their community for so long. And they look at it and they say they have no idea how to address it. They know that it will cost them tens of thousands of dollars and expertise that they don't have. And the last thing they could do is go to their county and ask for $40,000 to go conduct the rescue on a case like this. It's just not something that is widely accepted in these rural communities. And the bad guys are hiding out in these rural communities. I mean, that's where these dog fighters and the puppy millers are. They're thick into the woods where they can't be found. So what we do is we come in. Typically, we identify the case. We start an investigation. We build the case. And then we bring it to the local authorities and say, here's the case. Here's what's going on in your community. Here are the violations, and we are here to provide the resources to make it happen. And so typically it's not really, they're usually very excited and welcome us in with open arms because they're quite surprised that we even exist and that we can now address, or they collectively, we can now end the suffering in their community. But, there really isn't an option once we've designed the case because the cruelty is very clear. As long as we can prove that, then we go in and what we need law enforcement for, obviously, is to build the case or to take our investigation and get a search and seizure warrant
based on our information. And then we go in and we seize the animals under the authority of the local authority. We care for them, awaiting what's called a custody hearing, and those typically take place within 10 days after seizing the animals. So once we've seized them, they're not ours, and they're not the county's. But we've never lost a custody hearing, so by the time we get to the custody hearing, we win possession of the animals, and then we place them. Meanwhile, we will have built all of our evidence. The animals themselves are evidence because, you know, they come in emaciated and matted if they're dogs. And we record all of this. We document everything through written materials by veterinarians, photos, video, and we build a very strong case. And then typically, you know, 6 months to a year later, I'm in a courtroom testifying on a criminal violation against this person or persons.
Thank you so much.
So there's a lot that goes into it. It's very complex. There's many moving parts. It's not as simple as maybe some of our videos show, where we go in, we save them, and then we, you know, show an animal living as an animal for the very first time.
Thank you so much for all this work you're doing. I know you've seen a lot of terrible situations in your many years of experience with animals, and I'd like to know if you can remark on what needs to change in human society in order for these massive, terrible situations with dogs, cats, monkeys, everything that you've seen. What needs to change in our society and, I guess, in human mindset to change the way that animals are treated like this?
It's changing. It's I'm hopeful and confident that things are changing and will continue to change. And I believe, you know, every animal protection organization plays a role in this change, whether it be through direct action like Animal Rescue Corps, advocacy like some other groups, legislative efforts, so on and so forth, spay and neuter efforts. We all play a role. But I think the greatest role we play, more than anything else, is leading by example. And if we continue to lead by example and increase the visibility of the plight of animal suffering, then I believe the world will change. I believe compassion exists within everybody. Unfortunately, some people see it as a sign of weakness, and they stuff it deep down. But once you embrace compassion, I believe compassion to be our greatest strength.
That's so well said. So obviously you do still take volunteers to help with the organization, and you mentioned having a set of 1,000 volunteers across North America. Can you tell us about what volunteering for Animal Rescue Corps entails, what volunteer opportunities exist, and then what one must do to get involved?
I'm sure. It's pretty easy to start. You just go to our website, animalrescuecorps.org, and you click on the join button, and there you just put in your email address, and you'll get updates from us on our work as well as our upcoming volunteer opportunities, whether it be a volunteer training course, whether it be an event we're going to be attending, or what we're doing currently. But once you've signed on, we put you in a database, and we'll have you, you know, identified as being somebody we could deploy in a certain area. We'll work with anybody and deploy anybody because there's something everybody can do, whether it's administrative, whether it's, you know, cleaning a cage, walking a dog, socializing an animal that's never been socialized before. Now, there's always something. And as once you're in and we start working with you and you develop in your skills, and we expand on what we have you do for the organization. But I will tell you, everybody who's ever deployed with us, believes it to be a life-changing experience. It doesn't seem to be anything quite as important when you're in a position where you're reaching into a cage where an animal has existed their entire life. You're looking into their eyes and making them the promise that their suffering has ended forever at your hands. I mean, I just can't imagine anything more important than that.
I think that's a great note to end our interview with. And I have to say, I have been truly inspired by you and the work that you've done. And I'm definitely getting on your volunteer list as well as looking into that this week. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Scotland, to speak to us about Animal Rescue Corps and the dog rescue operation that your organization has been currently doing in Quebec. To find out more about Animal Rescue Corps, please visit their website at www.animalrescuecorps.com. Is it .com or .org?
.org. Okay. Thank you for having
me. Thank you so much. Take care.
You are listening to Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM, CFRO, Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Stay tuned for future episodes where Alyssa will be doing a second part.
Second installment of Love, Sex, and Veganism. I'd like to just discuss.
Is that next week?
No. Oh, okay. I'm going to talk about goats next week.
Yeah.
Yes, that's what I'm going to do.
Next week is goats.
Goats and goat's milk. We'll do animals. But I do want to talk about relationships again because I have just so much more to cover.
Awesome. All right. Yes. Yeah, so next week, stay tuned for Alyssa's segment on goat's milk. And I will also be doing an interview with Ellen Jones, author of the book Vegan on $4 a Day, which I'm very excited to learn more about and talk with her about. So keep up to date and stay informed. You can follow us on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, our Twitter page, which is Animal Voices YVR, our website, www.animalvoicesradio.com,
and animalvoices.org.
Yes. And you can contact us via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening, and remember to be kind to the animals. So up next, we will be playing Feeling by Jane Alderman, which tells the story of animal rescue, and the touching music video can be viewed on our Facebook page.
Starting tomorrow. We're going to make you wait.
Got a feeling that you're someone special. I've got a feeling about you. I know I just met you, but I can't forget. No, I'm sure this is our first. It's like heaven has not forgotten me. So overwhelming, the first time I held you. A baby, I know it sounds crazy. What is this happening in my heart? And it's different than expected. Song that I have heard for the first time. Yeah. I never bet all my dreams on that one in a million. got a feeling about